Today is Thursday, June 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. calls for restraint as Hong Kong protests turn violent. President Trump says he would take information about an opponent from a foreign country. Also ahead, a congressional committee holds two top administration officials in contempt for refusing to comply with subpoenas. It's all on today's International Edition. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe landed in Tehran Wednesday on a mission to ease tensions between the U.S. and Iran. His arrival came just hours after Iranian-backed rebels in Yemen launched an attack on an airport in Saudi Arabia, wounding 26 people. Abe's trip is the highest-level effort yet to de-escalate the crisis as Tehran appears poised to break the 2015 nuclear deal it struck with world powers. The Trump administration pulled out of the deal last year. Joining us to talk more about what this might achieve is Ben Taliblo of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. So Abe met with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. So far, what are we seeing, and did anything stand out to you?
It's really still difficult to read the tea leaves coming out of Tehran on the success or failure of Shinzo Abe's visit. We know, of course, there was an offer floated while Trump was in Tokyo to essentially have Japan mediate, not necessarily on America's behalf, but between America and Iran, both of which Japan has had close relations with. It's a U.S. ally, of course, and Japan has had relations with both the pre-revolutionary government of the Shah and the Islamic Republic. Abe, of course, his trip is historically significant because it's the first time a Japanese sitting prime minister has gone to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It's been 41 years since that has happened. And Abe actually accompanied his father when he was a much younger man, because his father was foreign minister and went to Iran in the early 1980s. The real marker for success or failure, given this historicity, of course, will come tomorrow. Not because of who Abe is, but because who Abe is meeting with tomorrow. Tomorrow he meets with Iran's Supreme Leader Khamenei, who ultimately controls Iran's foreign and security policy, and any message he wishes to convey from Trump or any offer to get Iran to back down or to enter negotiations or basically help alleviate Persian Gulf tensions should be made there and would have most effect if made there.
I'm curious as to why it's Abe doing this. Of all the leaders around the world, not Switzerland, not, you know, some of the others that we would think as mediators, why Japan?
It's probably a confluence of forces, but again, because Abe actually accompanied his father to Iran in the early 1980s, that was a mission by Shintaro Abe, his father, to help mediate between Iran and Iraq during the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War. And while that mediation effort ultimately failed, it was not unheard of for Japan to try to alleviate tensions, even then, 30 years ago, to put an end to Persian Gulf insecurity, because so much of Japan's oil is from the Persian Gulf, and essentially all of its oil is imported. So there's always been a strong mercantilist economic interest of Japan in that region, which has fostered this kind of mediation diplomacy.
How is it possible, though, to diffuse tensions if the United States is placing these sanctions on Iran, and it's obviously working, it's hurting their economy, it would appear, and yet Iran is saying if it continues, the U.S. shouldn't expect to, quote, say, stay safe. First of all, it seems almost like a stalemate, and secondly, what do you think they mean by that, to stay safe?
I think, well, that is Zarif making good on a threat that makes him indeed earn the title of foreign minister of the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism. Can't be a moderate and make such threats against the U.S. Full stop. But more broadly, how could Japan try to convey a message to Iran, or what could Japan be doing to kind of bring about an end to the sanctions? Well, essentially what they could do is incentivize Iran to come back to the table, put away this notion of resistance economics, to not retaliate either directly or indirectly against American or allied interests in the Persian Gulf, and, of course, to engage in good faith with Washington, which has, for a Republican administration, essentially bent over backwards to try to lend a hand to Iran, whether it's through the discussion, the public offer of talk, calling the country by its formal name, the Islamic Republic, or, of course, saying that the policy is not regime change, and, of course, putting full normalization of relations on the table. That is a historic window that Abe would be wise to cite for Tehran's leaders and to get them to come to the negotiating table.
That's Benham Bentalablu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Separately, the front page of a daily newspaper in Iran Wednesday morning published a picture of a mushroom cloud from a nuclear blast in reference to America's bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. And it said, quote, "How can you trust a war criminal, Mr. Abe?" The newspaper asked that in dual English and Farsi headlines. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. joins the effort to salvage an agreement with Sudan. U.S. and Turkey tensions are escalating over Russian missiles. Key lawmakers are seeking greater transparency from the U.S. Pentagon. And an additional 1,000 U.S. troops will be sent to Poland. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A U.S. House committee voted Wednesday in favor of holding two of President Trump's closest advisors in contempt of Congress for defying congressional subpoenas related to an effort to add a citizenship question to the 2020 U.S. Census. By a 24-15 bipartisan vote, the House Oversight Committee recommended the full House of Representatives find Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt. For Barr, the top U.S. law enforcement official, it was the second time a House panel had made such a recommendation against him. Committee Chair Democrat Elijah Cummings said the census is critical to our democracy.
That includes making sure that it is used properly to allocate federal funds, apportion legislative districts, and for other purposes.
Trump earlier in the day asserted executive privilege to keep under wraps documents related to his administration's push to add a citizenship question to the census, defying a subpoena from the committee. During a nearly seven-hour meeting of the Democratic-led investigative panel, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan argued in favor of the White House position of the citizenship question.
Why don't they want to know? Why don't they want to know something that everyone in our district knows should be asked, knows has been asked, is just good common sense.
But Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez sees it as a way for Republicans to rig voting districts.
I want to know why this question was magically added after we have seen that a political operative knew and detailed an intent to intimidate racial and immigrant communities for a partisan purpose, saying this will hurt Democrats and help Republicans. That's what I want to know.
A Justice Department spokeswoman in a statement said the committee was playing political games and that the agency had tried for months to accommodate the committee's demands for documents. Trump, a Republican, and Democrats in control of the House are locked in a political battle over the legislature's power to hold the executive to account. Trump and members of his inner circle have repeatedly ignored official demands and requests from Congress for documents and testimony. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, called the contempt vote an empty stunt. President Trump Wednesday said that if a foreign power offered dirt on his 2020 opponent, he'd be open to accepting it and that he'd have no obligation to call in the FBI. The role of Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., in organizing a 2016 meeting with a Russian lawyer offering negative information on Hillary Clinton was the focus of special counsel Robert Mueller's probe of Russian meddling in the last presidential election. Mueller painstakingly documented Russian efforts to boost Trump's campaign and undermine that of his Democratic rival. But Trump said in an ABC News interview on Wednesday that there was nothing wrong with listening.
Your son, Don Jr., is up before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. And again, he was not charged with anything. In retrospect, though,
by the way, not only wasn't he charged, if you read it, with all of the horrible fake news, I mean, I was reading that my son was going to go to jail. This is a good young man, that he was going to go to jail. And then the report comes out, and they didn't even say, they hardly even talked about
him. Should he have gone to the FBI when he got that email?
Okay, let's put yourself in a position. You're a congressman. Somebody comes up and says, hey, I have information on your opponent. Do you call the FBI?
I don't think it's coming from
Russia, you do.
I'll tell you
what, I've seen a lot of things over my life. I don't think in my whole life I've ever called the FBI. In my whole life. You don't call the FBI. You throw somebody out of your office. You do whatever
Al
you
Gore have. Got a stolen briefing book. He called the FBI.
Well, that's different. A stolen briefing book. This isn't a stolen. This is somebody that said, we have information on your opponent. Oh, let me call the FBI. Give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
The FBI director says that's what should happen.
The FBI director is wrong.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI. If I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with Oppo research, right? They come up with Oppo research. Oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it. But you go and talk honestly to congressmen. They all do it. They always have. And that's the way it is. It's called Oppo research.
Several of Trump's Democratic opponents in the 2020 race, including Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Kirsten Gillibrand, repeated their calls to begin impeachment hearings in the wake of the president's latest remarks. Trump's comments came just a month after he pledged not to use information stolen by foreign adversaries in his 2020 reelection campaign, even as he wrongly insisted he hadn't used such information to his benefit in 2016. Hong Kong authorities shut down government offices in the city's financial district for the rest of the week after another day of violence over an extradition bill that would allow people to be sent to mainland China for trial. Wednesday night was the third night of violence since a protest Sunday drew what organizers said was more than 1 million people in the biggest street demonstration since 1997. Handover. Overnight, several thousand demonstrators remained near the legislature in the Admiralty District, while thousands more retreated to the Central Business District, overlooked by the towers of some of Asia's biggest firms and hotel chains. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke to Aaron Hale in Hong Kong, who has been covering the protests, and asks if this is just the beginning of things getting the beginning of an even bigger crackdown.
Definitely. If you compare this to 2014's democracy movement protests, you know, there was a little bit of tear gas used in the beginning, but we didn't really see violence for several weeks until police decided to, you know, finally clear the protest sites. Today, you know, you have the police moving in very fast, and you also had a lot more anger from protesters about this bill. I think they really see this as like a last stand for Hong Kong. So, you know, you have both sides really taking a much harsher stance.
Does this escalate the situation then, as you could see it?
I would say so. You know, the government has said that they're not going to back down. They've made the vote for June 20th. They made it very clear. So instead of de-escalating the situation, maybe waiting a few months for the legislative recess, you know, they're just pushing the, you know, really pushing it forward, and that's making people very angry.
In light of the statements made by Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's chief executive, that she'll continue to move forward with the extradition bill, what lies ahead for the protest? Does this intensify it along with the violence, or does it actually ride less into the days ahead, as seems to have happened before this violence broke out?
It's hard to say. When I left this evening, you know, a lot of people had left for the day. They were trying to hold the lines, people who remained, but riot police were coming in and removing barricades. I think, though, that we are going to see a lot more civil disobedience, you know, from the protesters, though, in the days to come. Whether or not it will be protests that are violent is hard to say.
When you talked to many of the protesters to whom you spoke yesterday, being Wednesday, what was their attitude? Was it anger? Was it frustration? How would you judge that?
There was a lot more anger than, for example, in Sunday's protests. A lot of the protesters are very young. They see this as like a last stand for Hong Kong. You know, they say that they're fighting for their home, and they're very, very afraid of what this will mean if the bill passes, that they're going to really lose Hong Kong to China. So, yeah, it was very angry and very upset.
The changes, these proposed changes, have attracted criticism from the international community, including the United States. China accused the U.S. Tuesday of interfering in its internal affairs. Does that have any bearing whatsoever on what happens in Hong Kong, this external pressure from other countries?
Usually it would. You know, the business community community does not criticize the Hong Kong government very much. The American Chamber of Commerce coming out and criticizing this, that was, fairly uncommon. But I think Carrie Lam is weighing those concerns. She's hedging them against what Beijing probably wants from her. And I think she's decided to bet on Beijing.
What is the life on an everyday basis, if you can tell, about somebody's life in Hong Kong? Is it totally disrupted? Are a lot of people going through with their normal days, or is this totally disrupting everything?
Well, 1,000 businesses, mostly small businesses, did close, so this has disrupted things somewhat. It definitely shut down Central, Admiralty, Wan Chai areas, which are sort of the major business and the major government districts. However, offices have, a lot of them have said that people can have flexible work hours. So this did disrupt things. If it will disrupt them for as long as the umbrella movement did, it's hard to say.
That's VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking by Skype to reporter Aaron Hale in Hong Kong. The bill, which will cover Hong Kong residents and foreign Chinese nationals living or traveling through the city, has sparked concerns it may threaten the rule of law that underpins Hong Kong's international financial status. A 5-year-old boy has died of Ebola in Uganda in the first cross-border case of the virus since an outbreak began last year in eastern Congo. Ugandan health officials are mobilizing to prevent the virus from spreading to other parts of the country. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Ugandan health officials said the boy and 5 family members crossed into Uganda on June 10th from eastern Congo, where health workers have been fighting an outbreak of Ebola that has infected more than 2,000 people. More than two-thirds of those patients have died from the hemorrhagic fever caused by the virus. The young boy was the first confirmed Ebola case in Uganda since the outbreak began. Uganda's health minister, Ruth Acheng, says the boy's family members have been isolated and are being tested for Ebola.
Here in the Ebola treatment unit, the 5-year-old who tested positive first, who passed away at 9:30 p.m. last night. Right now, his grandmother and his younger brother, 3-year-old, have also tested positive, bringing us to a total of 3 confirmed cases. We have 7 suspects.
Ugandan officials said the Democratic Republic of Congo alerted them on Monday to the family's border crossing after they visited a relative in the DRC who later died of Ebola. The family was found when they checked into a border area hospital after the boy fell ill. Uganda had already stepped up controls on the border in an effort to prevent Ebola from entering the country. Acheng says Uganda, the World Health Organization, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, are now taking steps to stop the virus from spreading further.
The Ministry of Health, WHO and CDC will undertake ring vaccination of contacts to the case and other non-vaccinated frontline health workers, as well as other workers beginning 14th June 2019. Uganda's preparedness has been converted into a response mode.
But Red Cross Emergency Preparedness and Response Manager Paul Okot warns the border checks cannot fully control movement from the DRC.
There are a lot of informal crossing points that people pass through. They have relatives across the border and they cross anyhow. For us, we are stationed at official border points that the immigration people have gazetted. Sometimes they cross when we are not at the station. We close the border at 7, and so our screening team also leave the border points at 7.
Uganda's Ebola outbreak in 2007 killed 22 people in the western district of Bundibugyo. The country's worst outbreak was in 2000 when 425 people were infected with Ebola and half of them died. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, all across Europe, countries are taking big steps to protect the environment and focus more on conservation. And now France is taking a big move, making a big move when it comes to recycling. Joining us to hear more about that is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, what exactly are they doing?
This follows on from legislation which came in France in 2016, when France was pretty much leading the way in banning the sale, the use of single-use plastic bags. So they're now trying to take it that next big step further, and they're trying to bring in legislation which would ban retailers from destroying unsold consumer products. So this would be anything from sort of shoes, it would also be electrical items, clothing, and that, they say, is simply because they've now got the figures, and the government says that around $750 million a year of consumer products are either discarded or destroyed in France. Now, the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, said this is just too much. Mm. Destroying non-food goods is just not really what a country like France should be doing in this day and age. So they've brought in a huge package that's going to go before Parliament in the next few weeks that will be part of what's known as this bringing in a circular economy. Now, what that means is that you stop people and the whole economy working on this basis of a, what's called a take, make, and waste industrial model, and you bring in more products that can be reused rather than disposed. And so they're looking at that, and what also gave it this real push was that a couple of months ago, there was a documentary on French television which showed some of the major online retailers just destroying some of the products that had been sent back to them because customers weren't happy with it or they thought it wasn't what it was. And there's just such a public outcry that this was happening to such an extent.
And this planet is pretty much overrun with stuff that we've made and disposed of that we just don't want anymore because something better came along, or it sounds like a completely innovative idea.
It is fairly innovative, but on the other hand, you have to remember that in the European parliamentary elections that we had right across Europe last month, Green parties did exceptionally well. They really did steal the show. They took a huge proportion of the vote in all the countries, and it did show that these Green parties have put sustainability on the absolute front of all of the political agendas across Europe. And so in lots of ways, you could say that the French are reacting to what's also out there, that this movement has been just building up and building up, and this generation now, this younger generation that's coming along, they're holding these Fridays for Future marches across Europe, they're now voting, asking for tighter laws when it comes to the environment, that they are really pushing this whole agenda. And then, yes, it is easy to say that France is doing well because it's introduced this ban on plastic bags, but a lot of European countries also have that.
Right.
One of the interesting ones that France did come up with, which caught a lot of attention, was when France became the first country in the world to prohibit supermarkets from throwing away unused food. I mean, they brought in legislation that meant that supermarkets, if food was not sold, that it couldn't be thrown out. They have to go and donate it. They have to go and donate it to a soup kitchen, or they face a fine.
It's interesting because, as you mentioned, with the Green Party really doing so well across the region there in Europe in last month's elections, there could be more pushes to get to zero waste, like we just heard about in Slovenia.
Well, indeed, zero waste is really the way that many of the countries are looking at. And whilst on the one hand you have France saying, well, look, you know, we've really done a great deal when it came to plastic bags. It was a situation where France was using 80 plastic bags per person per year. Well, you look at some of the other European countries, Denmark and Finland, they were using 4 plastic bags per person per year. So to an extent, France can be proud that it's made this move, but other countries are just so far ahead. We're looking at nowadays of it being very normal to talk in Europe of having car-free town centres, of having it cars had to be kept on the outside of the city centre, and you have buses, electric buses or hybrid buses that take people into the centre. These sorts of ideas or innovations that perhaps 20, 30 years ago were a bit strange, this is now the mainstream. And I think that's really one of the interesting points that's come from this new generation that's voting green, is that things that were innovative 10, 15, 20 years ago, they are in the mainstream and they're pushing for them now.
All right, that's Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. The U.S. National Aeronautics Space Agency has unveiled a brand new street name at its headquarters in Washington, D.C. E Street Southwest in Washington will now be known as Hidden Figures Way, in honor of the women who worked as human computers at the agency when it first launched astronauts into space in the 1960s. At a renaming ceremony outside NASA headquarters Wednesday, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine unveiled the street sign inspired by the 2016 film Hidden Figures, which tells the story of three African-American women who worked for the agency at a time when racial segregation and gender discrimination were the norm in America.
I just want to say thank you for coming to the NASA headquarters here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. What an amazing day. What an amazing event. What an amazing opportunity to honor such amazing Americans. I want to start by thanking the families of, and I'd like you to give a big round of applause for each of these members I'm about to mention, the family members of Katherine Johnson. The family members of Dorothy Vaughn. And the family members of Mary Jackson. And I just want to say, these were the three hidden figures in a very prominent book that became a magnificent movie that started a movement that brought all of us here today. But they are a small piece of the overall, I guess, cadre of professionals that helped us not just get into orbit, but also get to the moon, the people of NASA who are now known as the Hidden Figures. So thank you to all of the hidden figures throughout history that have made NASA such a successful agency.
The women are touted as with overcoming these obstacles to play a critical role in launching the first U.S. astronauts into space. The story of an American musical icon and activist is now on the big screen and on Netflix. Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, is a semi-fictional documentary that chronicles Dylan's drive in a Winnebago van-led caravan by musicians, artists, and poets on a nationwide musical extravaganza across post-Vietnam America in the late 70s. Several of his songs became anthems for the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. Bob Dylan has sold more than 100 million records, making him one of the best-selling musical artists of all time. Been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director Tracy Carter and our engineer Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Vacuum of
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday that he would see nothing wrong in accepting damaging information on a U.S. political opponent.